Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Well, I'm going to stop at this point and invite questions. We're going to encourage you to come to the microphones. And if you're too shy to come to the microphone, you can write out your question and have one of our volunteers here read that question for you. And I know this audience is large enough that not all of you are going to get to ask your questions, which is why it reasons to believe we have a daily telephone hotline. Don't call us Christmas, but the other 364 days, we're ready to take your phone calls. And that specific time, that would be, 7 to 9 p.m. Texas time. And also, once a week, we do a two-hour live radio webcast where we talk about the past week's scientific discoveries and use these discoveries to test various creation evolution models, including our own. It's live. We invite you to call in with your questions. But you're also welcome to listen to it archive. We archive every single show with detailed notes, so you can go to our website and participate either that way or get an MP3 or a CD or whatever you want. And then we make available this magazine called Connections free of charge. This is a magazine that keeps you up to date on a few of the latest scientific discoveries that give more evidence for the God of the Bible. So we have people behind the microphones. The one rule we're going to have here is this. You can ask any question you want, but one question per person per turn. If you've got six questions, I'm going to ask you to take six separate turns. So we'll start with this gentleman here and go back and forth. Yeah, go ahead. You first.
Yeah, thank you. You're definitely full of what we call intelligence. I believe the ability or the willingness to take a lot of observations, what we might call facts, and take those in and then let it out to us. And your ability to do that is remarkable. Let me just start off with the fundamental level, which is what I tend to do sometimes. This idea of veritas, we know this to be truth. In most books that you see that describe the term, and I think it's wise for this forum to use the term veritas instead of using the term truth. I would like you to address, talk a little bit about why it's important that we be in possession of the absolute truth. That is to say, why is it better to... Now, let me give you an example. I grow tomatoes a certain way, and my grandfather grows tomatoes a certain way. I tend to not use any herbicides or pesticides or intensive methods. He, on the other hand, is a little bit old-fashioned, and he says, this has worked for me for years. I'm gonna stick with it. My tomatoes taste pretty good. I don't have any complaints about them. He loves his tomatoes. Now, again, the question, this idea of truth, the Christian truth, which I respect, and I think it's important to, go after the truth. I like that, and that's one of the things I like about the living. Give me some of your thoughts on why it's important to be in possession of absolute truth. Because what I see happening around the world is we've got a lot of different truths, and we have a lot of conflict. But I think I've said enough, and you understand.
Yeah, I got the question.
Okay.
Okay.
Forgive me.
I don't think that we can gain absolute truth about anything. We are within the space-time realm of the universe, which means our capacity to know absolute truth about anything in the universe is limited. Now, I would argue that the God that created the universe has absolute truth, and he's given us a means by which we can approach that absolute truth, but I don't think we'll ever gain it. So, for example, when I married my wife 28 years ago, I reminded her that I was marrying her without absolute truth of her existence. All I had was a high scientific probability. But I can tell you, after 28 years of marriage, that probability has increased. But it's still not at the level of absolute truth. And what I was trying to communicate here in my message is a tool by which we can gain greater and greater confidence in that what we're looking at approximates to a high degree the absolute truth that only God possesses. In fact, I would argue God has given us a method for putting things to the test that as we practice that biblical interpretation method, what many of you know as a scientific method, that allows us to get closer and closer to gaining more and more knowledge about our subject matter and therefore getting closer and closer to that absolute truth. But in that sense, we will never possess absolute truth. But hopefully we can come to a position where we recognize that our practical proof is certainly good enough. And that's what I told my wife the day I got married. I said, look, I don't have absolute proof of your existence, but the experimental evidence that I've been able to accrue convinces me that you exist to a sufficient degree I'm prepared to commit the rest of my life to. In that sense, okay. I can't give you absolute proof I exist either.
Considering your talk tonight, I appreciate that answer.
Okay, this gentleman right here.
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes. Yeah, I can hear you.
Your numbers are extraordinary for your presentation today. It was very interesting, but your numbers have taken at face value would make it very difficult for somebody to be an atheist in your field, but the vast majority of the National Academy of Sciences is atheistic. Now, how would, including Stephen Hawking, whom you used a lot in your presentation today, how do you explain this discrepancy? I'm particularly interested in that.
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. Well, Stephen Hawking does not identify himself as an atheist. It'd be correct to refer to him as a deist. He has written in his books that the beauty of mathematics by itself demands the existence of a God, but his view of God is a God that performs all of his miracles when he creates the universe and takes a vacation after that time. So in that sense, I think it's correct to refer to him as a deist. Now, in the next book I'm bringing out in September, I mentioned surveys of scientists and their belief in God. There was a good scientific survey done in 1916 by the philosopher Leuba, in which he surveyed men and women across the American scientific research area. He restricted it just to research scientists. And what he discovered was that somewhere between 40 and 45% of all research scientists in the United States believe in God and an afterlife. That's 1916. That same survey was repeated in 1996, and they got the same percentage, 40 to 45%. And when that was published in the British journal Nature, there were scientists here in the States who said, well, wait a minute, that's just a survey of the general research science population here in the United States. Admittedly, all of them had PhDs and all of them were working in research. And they tried to claim that the greater scientists, you have only a 15% belief in God. And that's the basis of this claim, that with the National Academy of Sciences, you have a much lower percentage of people believing in God. However, that is not a fair survey. The survey where they simply looked at all the men and women who are research scientists in the U.S., there's a book out called Men and Women of Science. And what the study did is a random survey of those men and women of science. On the other hand, members of the National Academy of Sciences are appointed by the few hundred members of the National Academy of Sciences. So you do not get an unbiased representation of research scientists in the National Academy. And I can tell you, there are outstanding scientists here in the United States that would be just as equal, if not greater, than the membership who are not members. So it's a private club. You only get to become a National Academy of Science member if you're nominated by the members. Total membership is less than 1,500. So it's a small sample. So where do they fit in scientifically? The first dinosaurs show up after the Permian extinction event, which took place 251 million years ago. That was a catastrophe that befell the Earth, where about 95% of all species, both marine and land species, were wiped out. And after that extinction, we have the Triassic dinosaurs showing up on the scene. And they remain on the Earth for a few tens of millions of years, and then they get wiped out by an extraterrestrial collision event. And after the demise of the Triassic dinosaurs, we see the sudden appearance of Jurassic dinosaurs. And this is significant. We have the complete destruction of the Triassic dinosaurs, and in less than 10,000 years, we see this burst of speciation of Jurassic dinosaurs. And they remain dominant in the face of the Earth for a few tens of millions of years, then they get wiped out by an extraterrestrial collision event. In this case, we can actually find the craters scattered across North America. And then the last generation would be the Cretaceous dinosaurs, and they persist until 65 million years ago when they got wiped out by an asteroid that hit the Yucatan Peninsula. So that's the dinosaurs. As I say, what possible role could they fulfill? Well, I'm reminded of a cartoon I once saw in a science magazine which showed a dinosaur on a psychiatrist's couch being interviewed by another dinosaur who was a psychiatrist. And the one on the couch said, "I keep having these recurring nightmares night after night, and they're highly symbolic." And he asked the good doctor if he could explain the meaning of what this was all about. And the doctor said, "Well, tell me, what are these symbols that keep coming up in your dream night after night after night?" And the answer was 10W30. Not that dinosaurs are the primary contributor of the oil we mine. That's not true. But over here. Do we have anyone in this microphone here? Okay, we'll pick up the next person here then. Yeah, you can come to the microphone, but I'll take this question first. Go ahead.
In one of your slides, you mentioned the term Christ designer.
Yes.
All the scientific evidences prove deism, but not theism. So isn't it a leap of faith going from deism to theism?
Well, I would argue you can go from deism to theism, in that we're demonstrating from these design characteristics a God that intervenes more than just at the creation of the universe. I mean, if all we looked at the universe, I think you might have a case. But when you look at the design features of the solar system, the collision event I showed, that testifies of a creator that intervenes more than just at the creation event 13.7 billion years ago, but throughout the whole history of the universe and life on planet Earth up until God creates a human being. So at that point, he rests from his creation work, and these design features seem to support that interpretation. So in that sense, we're not just talking deism, but theism. And then if we can actually measure these design features numerically, like I attempted to do at least partially in my talk, then we're talking about a creator who is personal, intelligent, knowledgeable, creative, powerful, caring, and loving. I haven't talked about that, but I think you can also make a case for looking at a creator that's orders of magnitude more caring and loving than we are, and now we're narrowing in on the God of the Bible. And that's really what we're attempting to do at Reasons to Believe, is say, okay, science can't prove that Jesus Christ is the creator in an absolute sense, but it can prove that it's Christ plus or minus an error bar. Is the error bar small enough to eliminate the alternatives? And I think more significantly, is that error bar getting progressively smaller and smaller as we learn more and more? This gentleman.
Okay, a last question. You proposed that mankind showed up on the scene about 50,000 years ago, which caught me off guard. By saying this, are you contending that, are you discounting the existence of macroevolution by saying this? Because you have an interesting proposal by saying that Earth was around 3.7 billion years ago, but saying
right,
mankind only showed up 50,000 years ago. You haven't really discounted the fact that things existed before mankind. Are you saying that evolution occurred until mankind, and mankind was specially created, or that God has a hand, a personal hand in the evolution of mankind?
Okay, I addressed a little bit of that in my lecture this afternoon in the chemistry department, but let me try to give a quick summary here. Is that our position is that God is responsible for all the life on planet Earth. The life that he creates does have some limited possibility to naturally evolve through natural selection, mutations, and gene exchange. But it's more limiting for the advanced species than it is for, say, the bacterial species or the viral species, if you consider viruses to be life. Most scientists do not. And so there's different levels of what kind of changes you can get in the species. But in terms of distinct speciation events, where you have a species that's distinct, radically different from the species that existed before, our position is to attribute that to the miraculous intervention of the Creator. Now, I'm talking as a scientist there. From a perspective of the Bible, I mean, I'm not only an astrophysicist, but I'm also a pastor. I speak on seminary campuses. And from a theological perspective, the Bible allows for some generous interpretation for the lower life forms. For example, it says of the plants, let the land produce plants. The verb there in the Hebrew is dasha, and it can be interpreted three different ways. That the land produces the plants through strictly natural process, or those plants come from previously existing life forms through strictly natural process, or you could interpret it that God supernaturally created all those plant species with direct miraculous interventions, or it could be a combination of the two. Therefore, reading Genesis chapter 1 is not going to answer the creation-evolution debate for you in the context of plants. However, when the text addresses birds, mammals, and human beings, it uses different words. It says of human beings and birds and mammals that God makes them and he creates them. Now, the word make, asah, means that God personally intervened to manufacture those creatures from previously existing material, the dust of the earth, if you will. And then the word bara means that he did something that was brand new that never existed before. And what you see in Genesis 1 is God makes three different kinds of life. Life that is purely physical, life that is soulish, and what that text means there is that life forms that not only are physical in nature, but are endowed with mind, will, and emotions, so that they can form significant emotional relationships with one another, and in particular with human beings. And then one species, the human species, that's body, soul, and spirit, where we would be capable of forming a relationship with God himself, and the capable, through our spirit, of engaging one another a level of relationship that's not possible for the birds and the mammals. So that really explains why we tend to choose birds and mammals for our household pets rather than cockroaches and ants. So a lot of them invade our homes on their own. But, you know, in terms of what kind of relationship you can have, it's the soulish creatures that give us the most fulfillment. So on that basis, from a biblical perspective, there's really not any room for natural evolutionary explanation for the speciation of birds, mammals, and human beings. And for what it's worth, it reasons to believe we've developed a speciation model that demonstrates that even from an evolutionary perspective, a Darwinian perspective, there is no possibility for vertebrate speciation. Bacteria maybe, but not the vertebrates. Over here.
Yes, sir. I was just wondering about the numbers that you hear on the slides, the 1 into 10, 240 million and all those numbers. I was just wondering, how is that created? Does somebody just sit down and figure out what exactly the probability is?
Okay, where do we come up with those numbers? Well, what we do is we take those 400-plus characteristics that must be fine-tuned and say, for example, like one of them talks about how planet Earth must be a certain distance from the sun in order to prevent a runaway freeze-up or a runaway boiling off of the water. And it turns out if you were to change that distance by 0.4%, that will sterilize the planet. Well, the question is, if you have a bunch of random planets, how many of those planets, by chance, would fit into that right distance relative to the sun to meet those conditions? So you come up with a probability there. And then you say, well, what kind of mass do you need in a star in order to present a source of heat and light that would allow life to exist on planet Earth long term? And what you discover is you were to change the mass of the sun by just a fraction of a percent, that would disturb the balance, especially for advanced life. Well, those are independent parameters. So you can take the probability of finding a star that has that just right mass and multiply that by the probability of having a planet at just right distance, and you get a more remote probability. Now, that works for a lot of these 400-plus characteristics we're talking about. But many of those 400, you would get dependent factors. In other words, you would have a characteristic that wouldn't be strictly independent of another characteristic. And so we have to carefully go through that and try to determine how much that dependency would increase the probability rather than decrease the probability. And then we also take into account that there might be a lot of planets out there that could reduce that probability, or pardon me, increase that probability. So that's how we calculate it. And if you go on our website, we actually have a paper up there posted which shows you all of our numbers, characteristic by characteristic, and how we actually come up with a bottom line calculation. So you can actually work it out for yourself. And for what it's worth, we've had some astronomers independently check our calculations. And I can tell you they don't get exactly the same probability we do, but they usually come within a factor of a million. And with all those zeros, that's only six zeros different. And so that verifies that these calculations are at least accurate enough to make the point.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.